As U.S. Israeli genocide in Gaza continues for 155th day, the death toll nears 31,000, mostly women and children. The spokesperson for Hamas military wing stresses priority to the striker prisoner swap deal is to completely end the aggression. And Yemen's army announces conducting two naval operations against American ships and destroyers in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden. Now, more than 5 months into Israel's genocidal campaign on Gaza, regime's bombing campaign continues taking innocent lives in the besieged Palestinian territory. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, at least 82 more Palestinians have been killed and 122 wounded in Israeli attacks since Friday. A number of the victims remain under rubble of bombed-out buildings or are left unattended in the streets as Israeli forces prevent emergency relief workers from reaching them. Death toll from the onslaught on Gaza that began October 7th is now approaching 31,000. Over 72,500 people have also been wounded, while thousands are still unaccounted for. 72% of the victims have been women and children. Our correspondent from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Bala, Moti Abu Musabe, joined us earlier with the latest on the humanitarian crisis amid Israel's incessant bombing campaign of Gaza.
Well, Danny, actually, it was a horrific night for the Palestinian people across all areas of Gaza Strip, as this genocide is still persistent in different areas of Gaza Strip. Let's begin from Rafah. At least four Israeli airstrikes hit the residential tower there, Al-Masri residential tower. It was completely destroyed by those vehement airstrikes. Dozens of the Palestinian injuries were reported and transported to the Abu Yusuf al-Najjar hospital in the city. While in Khan Yunis city, the Israeli airstrikes continued against different parts of the city, particularly the western parts. Several Palestinian residential buildings were destroyed and leveled to the ground over those relentless Israeli airstrikes, while the Israeli artillery maintained shelling both the western and the eastern parts of the city. In the meantime, the Israeli starvation war is still persistent against the Palestinian children. It was reported that three Palestinian children were reportedly died of hunger as they were suffering from the malnutrition and the dehydration. And the Israeli insistence on preventing those Palestinian children from having any real access to their basic humanitarian needs, particularly food, milk, and drinkable water, leaving them in severe conditions regarding the dehydration and the malnutrition, taking into consideration the collapse of the Gaza's health sector taking place amid this cruel Israeli assault on Gaza Strip. The real problem that the Palestinian civilians are facing here, which is about allowing thousands of the trucks and convoys crammed on the Egyptian side to enter into Gaza Strip. The U.S. administration and some regimes and countries are trying to overcome the main obstacle, and they are trying just to bypass the main obstacle, and they come up with insufficient, let me say, solutions in order to convince the public opinion.
Military wing of Hamas says the people of Palestine are facing unprecedented U.S.-Israeli hostility as the Gaza Strip is still under bombardment and siege. Spokesman for the Al-Qassam Brigades described Israel as an occupying regime devoid of humanitarian values, adding Nazi-like massacres are being perpetrated in Gaza. Abu Ubaidah noted the international law is unable to stop Israel from committing crimes against Palestinians. He said rules of the international community are worn out and ineffective, adding those rules are at the service of hegemonic powers. He also touched on a potential ceasefire, saying priority to strike a prisoner swap deal is ending the Israeli aggression completely. Ubaidah also referred to anti-Israeli operation launched by Palestinians back in early October. He emphasized Operation Al-Aqsa Flood was in response to decades of enmity and atrocities against Palestinians. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, says the Israeli regime tortured some of its staffers to falsely confess links to the Palestinian Hamas resistance movement. UNRWA's revelations came after some employees released from Israeli detention reported having been pressured deliberately to tell lies. They were subjected to various types of torture, including waterboarding, to admit that they'd participated in Al-Aqsa flood operation of Hamas. Meanwhile, UNRWA said it will hand over 11-page testimonies by its staff to relevant agencies specialized in documenting human rights abuses. The regime had leveled allegations that some UNRWA personnel were involved in the October 7th operation, prompting Israel's Western backers to cut off funding to the agency. UNRWA has been a lifeline for millions of Palestinians since 1949, just months after the creation of Israel in occupied Palestine. An Islamic resistance in Iraq says it's carried out more attacks on Israel in solidarity with Palestinians in Gaza. The resistance group said it targeted regime's intelligence base in occupied Golan Heights. Another attack targeted Israel's oil facilities in the port city of Haifa. Group says it used drones to hit the Israeli sites. There are no immediate reports of casualties or damage from the strikes. In recent months, the Islamic resistance in Iraq has carried out a series of attacks against Israel's positions in occupied territories. It's also attacked U.S. military bases in Iraq and neighboring Syria in retaliation for Washington's support for Israeli genocide in Gaza. The Yemeni army spokesman has acknowledged two fresh strikes on American naval targets in retaliation for U.S.-British acts of aggression against his country.
The naval forces and the air force of the Yemeni armed forces carried out two specific military operations. The first operation targeted the American ship Propel Fortune in the Gulf of Aden with a number of suitable naval missiles, while the second operation targeted a number of American destroyers at the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden with 37 drones, and the two operations successfully achieved their goals.
Saadi reiterated the Yemeni armed forces will press ahead with their operations in the Red and Arabian Seas until Israel halts its genocidal war against Palestinians and lifts its siege on Gaza. He also expressed gratitude to the Yemeni people for their demonstrations in the capital Sana'a and elsewhere in solidarity with Palestinians. Yemeni forces first launched operations against Israeli or Israeli-bound ships in the Red Sea in solidarity with Gazans, and recently they've intensified their attacks on U.S. and British ships in retaliation for the two countries' aggression against Yemen.
Yemenis from all walks of life gathered in the capital Sana'a and other major cities and chanted slogans in praise of the Yemeni army's naval operations. They also reaffirmed their full support for the Palestinian people and pledged to continue the protests until the Israeli genocide ceases.
The Yemeni government, all its members, its president and the people have one position, which is to support the Palestinian cause. We must thwart the American, Israeli and British project and stop starvation in Palestine. Our position is an honorable position, and our broad movement indicates that the Yemenis have great awareness and, God willing, victories for the nation will be at hand.
Protesters expressed support for the Yemeni army's naval operations against Western vessels, stating that the Palestinian cause helped the Yemeni people overcome the problems created by the Western powers in the country. They believe the conspiracy targets the whole region, not just Palestine or Yemen, and call on all Muslims to unite to thwart Western projects.
We went out today in Sana'a, as you can see, and in the rest of the governorates to announce to the world that our demonstrations and our position is a religious position that will not change with regimes or rulers. We will continue to insist on our position until our brothers in Gaza are victorious, receive food and medicine, and the U.S.-Israeli genocide against them stops. Our army will also continue its operations until the aggression against our country stops. Our operations are escalating, and upcoming strikes will stun both friends and enemies.
Our demonstration here in Sana'a and other governorates is to send a message that we as Yemenis have been able to overcome all the differences and problems that the enemies sought to create inside Yemen. The other message is that we continue to support the Palestinian cause, and what is happening in Gaza is shameful for all Arabs and Muslims. The operations of our army in the Red Sea and Bab al-Mandab are completely linked to what is happening to the people of Gaza, and the escalation of naval military operations is a legitimate move to support the Palestinian cause.
Recently, the Yemeni army intensified its naval attacks against American, British and Israeli-linked vessels and regional waterways, resulting in the sinking of a British vessel in the Gulf of Aden. It also attacked an American vessel, which the U.S. claimed led to loss of lives among the ship's crew members.
Yemenis assert that the success of Yemeni naval attacks, despite the presence of Western warships in the Red Sea and Gulf of Aden, demonstrates the capability and the high-tech weaponry possessed by the Yemeni army. They believe this achievement should inspire other regional forces to join the fight and support the Palestinians in face of the common enemies. Abdul Latif Roshali, Sana'a.
Thousands of Muslims have rallied outside the U.S. Embassy in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta, to condemn Israel's genocidal war against Palestinians and call for a ceasefire in Gaza. Carrying Palestinian flags and banners as well as chanting slogans, protesters marched down a major street outside the embassy despite heavy police presence. They halted traffic along the way. The demonstration was organized by more than a dozen Islamic groups which denounced U.S. support for Israel and demanded Washington push Tel Aviv to open more aid routes into Gaza as hunger worsens. Similar rallies were also held in South Korean capital Seoul in condemnation of Israeli atrocities.
This demonstration started at the Seoul Central Mosque as Muslims around the world are, you know, demonstrating in their opposition to the true genocide that's taking place now in Gaza, with the recent massacre happening in Rafah as people queued to receive humanitarian aid. This news is getting around the world and bringing people out in the street, like here today in South Korea, a country that really doesn't look too strongly at what's going on in the Middle East, and yet people are recognizing that, you know, yes, South Korea does have some involvement with countries in the Middle East, including a rather, you know, now contentious relationship with Israel, as it enjoys $4 billion in trade with Israel, as well as, you know, arms trade of tens of millions of dollars. Well, generally here, the government is trying to take sort of a middle course because, again, of its trade with Israel and its alliance relationship with the United States. Also, it relies, you know, at the same time on its energy security toward Saudi Arabia and the UAE. So the government has been slow both to condemn Israel and hesitant to condemn Israel.
In France and around the world, women and men took to the streets to celebrate International Women's Day. Gender equality is defined differently in different countries, but most agree that all societies need to improve their empowerment of women. Rami Mazahiri reports from Paris.
On the International Day for Women's Rights, demonstrations and pro-feminism strikes were held around France by women and the men who support their fight for equality. In October 1789, the Women's March on Versailles apprehended King Louis XVI at his luxurious palace and brought him to justice in Paris. But much work remains to be done in Republican France. Only 37% of French Parliament is female. Two-thirds of France's working poor are women, in large part because women compose 80% of France's part-time workers.
A return to far-right economic austerity after the COVID lockdowns hurt women more than any other minority. Women are more likely to work in the government and to use social services, so cuts to government budgets hurt them more than men.
In France, one woman is killed every 3 days by their partner or ex-partner. Our government must take more measures to protect the safety of our women. We also need policies which abolish the male-female pay gap and which better protect women from rape.
Israel's attempted genocide of Gaza has had a disastrous effect on women. From the starvation of 60,000 pregnant women to the forced displacement of 1 million females, to the inhuman and degrading treatment of women by Israeli forces, according to the United Nations, to the murder of nearly 10,000 women.
Israel's genocide in Gaza is an issue for all feminists and for all humanists. Anyone who thinks that we are at the wrong march are obviously just Zionist imperialists. And they also obviously do not understand what it means to support women with equality, respect, and justice.
Globally, 60% of poor people are women. They are paid 23% less than a man, even when doing the same work, and they spend 2.5 more hours doing domestic chores than men.
We have made some progress pushing women's rights to the forefront, but we must demand many other advancements. We must also not forget about the rights of girls, many of whom suffer from sexual violence, and who must be better protected and better represented by our government.
In France and much of the West, women suffer from widespread objectification and the commodification of their bodies. France allows the use of naked women in public advertising, which many say undermines its regular claim to be a feminist model which other nations must emulate. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
That's it for your latest here, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran while shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the Commander-in-Chief of Iran's Armed Forces, Imam Khamenei. Martyr Soleimani revived the resistance front and its strengthening must continue. December 31st, 2023. She, Zainab Soleimani, asked me to give her a word of advice. Very well, this is my advice. Be sincere in the things you do. In other words, don't let your egoism interfere with your intentions and your actions. Sincerity means working only for God. Wherever you have uncertainties about your egoism, distance yourself from that. In other words, it is better for a person to step away from a task rather than to do it in order to be seen. This is one point, the point about his sincerity. One point about the value of Martyr Soleimani's work, which has been and continues to be spoken about, is his role in reviving the resistance front in the region. This is a point that needs to be paid attention to. Of course, if someone is to speak about this, it should be spoken about correctly. Martyr Soleimani has played an important role in reviving the resistance front in the region, a very important role.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Sometimes we see there is a resistant group in a region. Well, yes, these existed before Martyr Soleimani as well. But there is a time when a front is created. This is what we always wanted. If the opposing side creates a front, this side must also create a front. If it weren't for this front, Gaza would not have been able to resist all this time. This resistance front gives strength to all aspects of the issue. If, for instance, four or five different groups unite, their power and strength will be more than five times as much as each individual group alone. A new identity will emerge. This new identity is very important. Martyr Qasim Soleimani played a significant role in this matter, and he worked very hard for it. People had seen his presence in the mountains of Syria, his fearlessness, and him moving toward danger. This is very important, but the main significance is that these trips, his presence, and these efforts were able to revive and strengthen the resistance front. May God exalt his rank. He pursued this work with forethought, with resourcefulness, with wisdom, with a moral behavior, with energy, and with endless effort. And this was and is very important. I hope that this movement continues by the will of God. Of course, now commander of the IRGC Quds Force is truly and honestly moving very well. Praise God, his endeavors are very good. This path of strengthening the resistance front, which Martyr Soleimani was very active in and very outstanding at, should be continued by the will of God.
Allah, I wanna thank you.
I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Last year, Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi visited three African countries, Kenya, Uganda, and Zimbabwe. During the historic visit, President Raisi witnessed the signing of bilateral cooperation agreements in economic, scientific, and educational sectors, among others. Immediate steps were taken to implement these agreements, and in this regard, Iran has granted full scholarships to Ugandan students to study in Iranian universities. The students will study diverse disciplines such as engineering, computer science, and business management. The Islamic Republic of Iran seeks to transfer technology to Africa and empower this continent that has for long suffered from exploitation by imperialist powers. Now, still on matters of technology transfer, Africa, a continent abundant in minerals, holds the key to the world's transition to a low-carbon energy future. Now, exploiting critical green energy transition minerals comes with challenges and opportunities. The export of raw materials has left the continent poor. Now, countries are working on their mineral value chain. Technical know-how is critical if mineral value addition is to take root in Africa. So, what are African countries doing to build local capacity for mineral value addition? Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and this is Africa Today. This week, we are focusing on Iran's academic cooperation with Uganda that has seen dozens of students from this East African country obtaining scholarships to study in Iran. The second part of our show is on how African countries can take advantage of the high demand for energy transition minerals available across the continent by implementing value addition initiatives.
Iran-Uganda Academic Cooperation. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi visited Uganda last July as part of his three-nation Africa tour. During the visit, President Yoweri Museveni called upon Iran to consider investing in Uganda's oil and gas sector, specifically by providing assistance in the development of the country's oil refinery.
President Raisi responded to the request by the President of Uganda, saying Iran is ready to transfer its know-how in the oil sector to Uganda. Now, as part of this transfer of technology program, Iran has granted scholarships to Ugandan students to study in Iran. For more on this scholarship program, we have contacted His Excellency Majid Safar, Iran's ambassador to Uganda. Thanks, Mr. Ambassador, for your time today.
Thank you so much. Thank you for giving me this opportunity again to talk about the bilateral relation between Iran and Uganda, especially regarding education.
Now, the Islamic Republic of Iran has granted scholarships to Ugandan students to study in Iran, as we've heard. Now, this is indeed a commendable step. Now, Mr. Ambassador, can you, first of all, elaborate on the number of students involved and the fields of study?
Yes, please. You know, in this round of cooperation, educational cooperation, Ahlul Bayt University of the Islamic Republic of Iran granted something like 70 scholarships to Ugandan students. Among the subjects that these students are going to study in Ahlul Bayt University, most of the subjects are, you know, engineering, And that is very important and interesting. The courses are like construction engineering, mechatronic engineering, computer engineering, which are very important for Ugandan students these days. Also, we have some social sciences and something like international relations, political relations, laws in some subjects of the law, also women studies, and management, commerce management, that are very important for Ugandan students these days. And we know that the Ugandan students would be happy for their studies in Iran.
The issue of gender parity is quite important, both in Uganda and in Iran. Therefore, Iran also pays special attention to women while awarding scholarships to foreign students. Mr. Ambassador elaborates on this.
The number of students are 70, and among them, around 20 to 25 of these students are among the ladies. And it is very important for a community like Uganda. And these ladies will study also, among them, and most of them are going to study in Atalbert University for engineering, computer engineering, and also construction engineering, and also mechatronic is among them. And it is very interesting from this point of view.
Iranian universities are ranked highly globally. Recently, the Islamic World Science Citation Center released the World University Rankings 2024 report, which includes 69 Iranian universities, compared to 63 in 2022.
Iranian universities are gaining popularity due to the high academic standards, and for sure, many across the world will want to study in Iran. Now, Mr. Ambassador, Iranian universities, as we know, are among the best in the region. So what criteria was used to award these scholarships?
The organization which we cooperate with them to nominate the students had advertised. They have advertised these scholarships in different medias. And they received so many applications from different parts of Uganda. And so many people have sent their documents, educational documents, to that organization. And then among them, they have selected something like, I think, close to 200 students. And then they have nominated and presented their documents, educational documents, to the embassy. And we have sent those documents to Tehran, to Ahlul Bayt University, and by considering their degrees, their qualifications, and different subjects that was important for the university, they have selected something like, as I've said, 70 students. And this is very important. We didn't present these, scholarships to selected people. And this is very important. And the most important thing was the level of education.
Ugandan officials have urged students awarded scholarships to live responsibly and use the opportunity to better their lives in addition to receiving education. Now, Mr. Ambassador, what is your advice to these Ugandan students who are already in Iran pursuing their studies?
The program for these students to see them off while they have been going to departure from Uganda to Tehran, I have told them that you should try to do your best because the universities in Iran are in very high level. You will receive a high level educations in different fields that you want to study in Iran. Therefore, they are sure that you will be another person regarding the level of your education. And you should be very helpful to Ugandan community and try to help the Ugandan people to work in the subjects that you are specialized in and to cooperate with the other, for example, foreign companies, to cooperate with them and try to bring the level of your activities in Uganda. While they are studying in universities. They are high-level educated people in different subjects. Therefore, they can create job opportunities.
The bilateral ties between Iran and Uganda are expected to expand, especially after the successful visit by Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi to Uganda last year.
And our last question, Mr. Ambassador, how will these scholarships boost Iran-Uganda bilateral relations, especially in the economic sector?
As we have mentioned and referred to the visits by the President of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Uganda, in the meetings between our two presidents, especially President Museveni, referred that we want to cooperate with Iran, for example, in refineries. We need refineries, and Iran is very professional in construction and installation of the refineries. And there are Iranian companies that are ready to cooperate in Uganda and to have some sort of activities in Uganda. And then if we have Iranian refineries installed in Uganda, then we have the possibility to export crude oil and then to produce different type of oil products, which are necessary in Ugandan market. And they are importing now. And even we can refine the Ugandan crude oil that in near future would be explored, and also the Ugandans are trying to export their crude oils. We can help them in these fields. And refining the oil, crude oil is also very important. And Iranian companies could be helpful in this field with Uganda, and not only to use it inside Uganda, but to cover the regional markets. All of this type of cooperation needs people who are professional in these fields, and this type of educational cooperation between Iran and Uganda would be much, much helpful in very near future, we hope.
Well, I'd like to thank Ambassador Majid Safar, Iran's ambassador to Uganda, for his insight on the scholarships awarded to Ugandan students who are already in Iran pursuing their studies. And now to continue our discussion on the academic collaboration between Iran and Africa, we are joined by Hussein Abdullahi, a Nigerian PhD student at the Faculty of Biology, University of Tehran. Thanks a lot for your time, Mr. Abdullahi. Now, first, tell us what motivated you to pursue your studies in Iran.
The reasons for coming to Iran for study are many. But the most important is the influence of my friend who came here to study in Tehran University of Medical Science in the name of Professor Rogo, who came here and studied. He has already explained to me a lot of things about the capability of the Iranian education and its quality. And therefore, I felt very, very interested to be here and study in this very important University of Tehran.
Let's now talk about academic standards. Mr. Abdullahi, how are the academic standards at the University of Tehran and Iran in general, particularly considering the fact that you also studied at high-ranking Nigerian universities?
What I can say here is that, of course, the standard of education here in the university, most especially in the University of Tehran, is very, very, very good.
Now, the quality of life and social integration is also important for foreign students in any country. Now, Mr. Abdullahi, how's life in Iran, and would you recommend other students to come and study here?
The life in Iran is relatively good in many, many aspects, although there are some economic sanctions that has been inflicted on the government and other individuals, but still, people, due to the good governance, people feel the presence of government, especially in the part of transport and food subsidy that is being provided.
Okay, now our time is running out. So our last question, Mr. Abdullahi, briefly tell us, what suggestions do you have for improved academic ties between Iran and Africa?
Okay, due to the fact that there are some similarities between Iran and Africa, but due to these similarities, it is very, very important for the nations of Africa and to have a cooperation, educational cooperation with Iran in the parts of education, because any national development is dependent on the education or education development of the country. So therefore, we are supposed to have a very good and standard education so that our nations are developed.
Well, I would like to thank Hassan Abdullahi, a Nigerian PhD student at the Faculty of Biology, University of Tehran. We now take a short break before the next segment of our show on Africa's strategic minerals. Stay with us.
Africa's strategic minerals. You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Africa is rich in strategic minerals such as lithium, graphite, bauxite, manganese, and cobalt, all essential for modern technologies. However, harnessing the value of these minerals requires investment in infrastructure, innovation, and sustainable practices, and developing the local industrial fabric.
These were some of the topics discussed at the African Mining Indaba 2024 that was held last February in Cape Town. The term Indaba comes from the Zulu language, which means a meeting to discuss a serious topic. This year, the Indaba is dedicated to the capitalization and development of mining in Africa.
South African President Cyril Ramaphosa addressed this world's largest mining investment conference. He said that the vast majority of minerals that are key to the global energy transition lie beneath Africa's rich soil.
The vast majority of the minerals that are key to global energy transition lie beneath the soil of the African continent, as you have heard my two brothers articulating earlier. These include manganese, iron ore, copper, cobalt, nickel, and the platinum group's metals as well. Africa has the potential to be the fulcrum of the global energy transition, with mining at its core.
To discuss the mining sector in Africa, we have contacted Matthew Parks, the acting national spokesperson and parliamentary coordinator of the Congress of South African Trade Unions, COSATU. Africa is now at the forefront of a transformative era as the world shifts towards sustainable energy sources. The continent's rich minerals reserves are emerging as a prerequisite for the global green technology revolution. Our first question to Matthew Parks, do you think there is enough political realization across Africa on the immense potential the continent holds in transforming the world?
No, we don't think so. I think in most countries across Africa, there isn't enough focus on it. There's not enough focus on many economic developmental issues or on the role the state should play in terms of trying to grow the economy. But I think if you look at the reports, most African countries really don't focus much on the issue of not just exporting raw minerals, which they do, but on beneficiating on investing in them locally to finish, to export a finished raw product. So most African countries really don't spend much time focusing on that, to be honest.
There is no doubt that Africa needs to tap on the continent's strategic mineral wealth for development, particularly by adding value by processing minerals before export.
So there's a need to look at beneficiating, to appreciate the importance of doing so, but also to kind of put in place the necessary investments from the state side to help facilitate that, to also create the partnerships between the public and the private sector to ensure that it does happen as well. Sometimes it does also require the states to put in place, for example, tax incentives or legislative requirements so it can happen. I think there's a need for the state just to take a much more proactive and much more creative approach, because almost all African governments have really played little more than lip service to this issue.
Developing countries, especially in Africa, which boasts 19% of global mineral reserves needed for EVs, stand to benefit from the green boom if they can process the minerals locally. Zimbabwe's government banned raw lithium exports in 2022 as it seeks to get more value from the mineral. Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa speaks during the opening of a lithium processing plant in the country.
Lithium is the mineral of the present and the future. Hence, its beneficiation and a value addition by Prospect Lithium Zimbabwe will position our country as an emerging and competitive player in the global lithium value chain world over.
Now, despite facing sanctions from Western countries, Zimbabwe took this historic decision to process lithium in the country. Mr. Parks, what's your take on this?
No, it's a positive decision. It's a decision that other African countries should look at and see how they can emulate that example. South Africa has also made similar, calls, commitments to do so previously as well. So it's a positive example. All African countries should look at it. For minerals, for petroleum exports, for other exports. It's an example that other countries across the world do it, whether it's in the Middle East or Asia, and it's something we should really be looking to do, not just have it as a commitment, but actually to implement it as well.
Speaking during the world's largest mining investment conference, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa spoke of persistent challenges impeding mining performance.
We are all acutely aware that we face strong headwinds and a number of persistent challenges are impeding mining performance. Globally, commodity prices are volatile, high energy prices, the geopolitical tensions that continue to prevail around the world continue to cause enormous challenges. And the global cost of living crisis is also playing a significant role in dampening the business operating environment.
And now, next question to Mr. Parks. What, in your opinion, are some of the challenges South Africa faces in its mining sector?
The challenge one is to actually to put in place the necessary infrastructure to beneficiate locally, to put in place the necessary technology and the skills. The business partnerships, to avail the resources, the financial resources to do so as well. It also means to create the export markets too. And really, we haven't done that. And I think we really need to find a way to make it profitable for businesses to do so, but I think also just to kind of compel them. But not only that, I think also put in place tax incentives to help make it even more attractive for them, because there will be some costs, but also to put in place the necessary tax penalties if they don't do so, and also the legislative requirements for them to do so as well.
A Bloomberg NEF study recently noted the cost of manufacturing lithium-ion battery precursors is three times lower in Africa than in the United States, China, or Poland. There is concern that multinationals are not doing enough to transfer technology to African countries.
And I think simply because maybe they find it easier to do so in the countries where they set up operations, perhaps they view African countries as being unstable. You might also find that their own countries' governments and shareholders put pressure on them as well. But again, I think it's just another additional reason why we should also put a bit of effort into it.
Since the days of the slave trade and colonialism, we have seen frequent and successful European attempts of hampering economic development in Africa.
Experts believe EU's policies on critical raw materials show the intent of renewing colonial cycles of exploitation and subordination by exploiting Africa's mineral resources. Now, our last question to Mr. Parks. Will Africa really be able to free itself from exploitation at this time when the world needs green energy minerals that are mostly in Africa?
If we don't show leadership, then those patterns will continue. It really requires governments to be much more thoughtful, to really be much more forward-looking about the continent's development, because the continent has not developed much since independence over 60 years ago. And yes, we can blame the West, that's fine. The West is doing what's in the West's interest. Africa also needs to do what's in Africa's interest, and most of the African governments for many years have just not paid attention, have been happy not to do it. So I think it requires a leadership shift in African countries to take this thing much more seriously. Otherwise, we will continue to stumble along as a poverty-stricken continent. And we simply need to look at the examples of many other countries, whether it's China or South Korea or Japan or Malaysia, who've really shown, even other countries across the Middle East too, to take control of the resources and to use it in a way which benefits that country's long-term socioeconomic development. Our resources are not unlimited. Eventually, you run out of a particular mineral or petroleum resource. And I think it shows that smart governments prepare for that economic transition. And I think, unfortunately, most African countries are not doing so. In fact, often when these commodities booms take place, they just simply go for the shortest route, often the least profitable route. And it's a really missed opportunity.
Well, there you have it. Only forward-looking leaders will enable Africa to reap the benefits presented by the global need for strategic minerals in the continent. And that wraps it up for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's always great having you. Thanks a lot and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world on The Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Salamun Alaikum. This is Lantern. On the continuation of Lantern, we have an interesting story. Of course, after listening to this story, we have the speech of the scholar and the important points of the story. By the selfless men who make a difference. In 1987, a 74-year-old rickshaw puller by the name of Bai came back to his hometown planning to retire from his backbreaking job. There he saw children working in the fields because they were too poor to afford the school fees. Bai returned to Tianjin in China and went back to work as a rickshaw puller, taking a modest accommodation next to the railway station. He waited for clients 24 hours a day, ate simple food, and wore discarded second-hand clothes he found. He gave all of his hard-earned earnings to support children who could not afford education. In 2009, he drove his rickshaw to Tianjin Yahoo Middle School to deliver his last installment of money. Nearby, 9 years old, he told the student that he couldn't work anymore. All of the students and teachers were moved to tears. In total, Bai had denoted a total of 350,000 yuan to help more than 300 poor students continue with their studies. In 2005, Bai passed away, leaving behind an inspiring legacy. If a rickshaw puller who wore used clothes and had no education can support 300 children to go to school, imagine what you and I can do with the resources we have to bring about positive change in our world.
We seek refuge from Satan the cursed in the name of Allah the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of Lantern from IRB English Radio. This is Zainab Musavi, and in the program of Lantern, what we do is to listen to certain religious stories and then try to take some religious lessons out of these stories and talk about them, expound them, and think more about them in order for us to take these lessons in our daily lives and make use of them and become better and better Muslims, inshallah. Well, our subject of talk for today is about helping and supporting others, which is highly recommended in our religion. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created the people in a manner that they remain associated and connected to one another so that by this way they strive to fulfill each other's needs and requirements. At times, a mu'min falls in the need of money for his house rent or treatment of disease or requires a recommendation in order to attain one's assistance. But some people, despite possessing the means and the ability due to some imaginary or apparent benefits, hesitate to offer their help. In such cases, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gets them entangled with their enemies in this world, while on the day of judgment, they shall be made to suffer punishment and chastisement. The recommendations and rewards related to fulfilling the needs of the people have been emphasized in such great measure that one is left amazed that despite this great path available for procuring the success in the hereafter, how very few are those who make the best of it. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam stated, "Fulfilling a need of a mu'min brother is better than liberating 1,000 slaves and giving 1,000 horses for jihad in the path of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala." Despite all the emphasis, it is the whisperings of the cursed Satan or Shaytan and attachment to this world, which prevents a man from helping out the others. Maymun ibn Mihran, one of the companions of Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam, narrated that, "I was sitting beside Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam when a man came up to him and said, 'O son of the Holy Prophet, I owe a person a debt, but do not possess any money to repay it, and so he intends to hurl me into prison. The Imam alayhi salam said, "Presently, I do not possess any money by which I can pay off your debt.
The man replied, "Then do something so that he does not put me into the prison." The Imam alayhi salam had been in a state of i'tikaf. You know, i'tikaf is an Islamic practice in which you must stay in the mosque for a period of time for certain number of days. So Imam al-Hasan alayhi salam at that moment put on his shoes and intended to move out of the